You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first episode of Seminary Dropout of 2018. Listen, you may know that late last year, I put out the call that we were trying to raise a goal of $100 per episode for Seminary Dropout, and that the show would resume once we reached that goal, and we've done it. And I'm so excited to announce that we've actually surpassed that goal. And I just want to thank you. You really answered the call. I'm so honored for those of you who have given, who are new givers and who are givers in the past. It really, really means a lot to me. And so that will be an ongoing thing that we're always trying to reach kind of a self-sustainability for Seminary Dropout. And so you can always go to supportseminarydropout.com and give, and you'll be supporting the show into the future. If you're in a place where you can't give at all, even a dollar a month or anything like that, that is perfectly fine. I want you to keep listening. Keep sharing and hopefully keep learning and growing from the content of Seminary Dropout. But I just wanted to say thank you, and you're the reason that Seminary Dropout is back for 2018. Okay, here you go. My guest, Kurt Thompson, is a psychiatrist in private practice in Falls Church, Virginia. He's also the founder of the Center for Being Known, a nonprofit organization that develops resources to educate and train leaders within the fields of mental health, education, business, and the church about the intersection between interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spiritual formation. Thompson is board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, and his main focus of clinical and research interest has been in integration of psychiatry, its associated disciplines, and Christian spiritual formation. Serving as an elder at Washington Community Fellowship in Washington, D.C., his duties have included preaching, teaching, and participating in the fellowship's healing prayer ministry. He and his wife, Phyllis, a licensed clinical social worker, are the parents of two children and reside in Arlington, Virginia. Kurt, thanks for being with me.
Shane, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Kurt, one of the things about this podcast is that it's not always timely. And case in point, I wanted to talk with you about your book, Anatomy of the Soul, which I think was published in 2010. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if that's a long time ago or not, as these things go, but yeah, sure. It was 2010.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly a new release, is what I'm correct. Trying to say. And in fact, you've written at least one book that I know of since then.
That's correct. Right.
Right. Anatomy of the Soul was one of those books that everyone that I kept talking to kept mentioning it, and is a few people who I interviewed on this show kept going back to Anatomy of the Soul. And so eventually I thought I need to check that out. And I'm so glad that I did. Mm. And it's also right up the alley of the kind of things that we really like to talk about on this show. Mm. The byline of the book is surprising connections between neuroscience and spiritual practices that can transform your life and relationships. Mm. So Your business, your vocation is psychiatry. Was being a psychiatrist something you always wanted to do?
You know, that's a great question, and I actually enjoy telling people this story, and I can be very brief. But the way the story goes, the short answer is no. Being a psychiatrist was not the first or seventh thing on my list of vocational aspirations. When I was in medical school, I spent the first 2 years being rather uncertain whether or not I really even wanted to be in medical school. I was not a guy who was exceptionally clear about his long-range vocational plans. And then when I was a third-year medical student, as I like to tell the story because this was my experience, I don't think that I discovered psychiatry as much as I think psychiatry found me. And I say that because I think in psychiatry, came to me a convergence of both the part of my heart that has, from the time I was young, been really curious about why we do the things we do as human beings. And I suppose that's largely because if I could get some answers to that question, you know, I could figure out my own, you know, wackiness and like what, you know, if mostly about figuring out like my own troubles. But combining that with the genuine intrigue that I had about neuroscience and about the way that we actually bring together, you know, who are we as people of souls, as the biblical narrative describes, and how does that make sense in a neurophysiologic standpoint? How does that make sense in terms of us being embodied beings, and from a medical perspective, and from the perspective of like, what difference does it make when we take antidepressants or when we do other things that shape who we are? And I then think a similar thing happened about now almost 15 years ago, not quite that long ago, when in my happening upon the work of my friend and colleague, Dan Siegel, who's a pioneer in this field of interpersonal neurobiology. At the time, I was about 15 years into my career as a psychiatrist and wandered into a workshop that Dan was teaching in New York. And this field of interpersonal neurobiology, I think, also was something that found me. I didn't find it, but it found me. And that has, I think, in many respects, opened portals vocationally for me to enter into that I, you know, would never have predicted. It's been a very humbling journey and a joy-filled journey to watch God, I think, use this material I think, give people a refreshed, energized, a renewed experience of what it means to follow Jesus. And so in all these respects, whether it's becoming a psychiatrist or wading into this field of interpersonal neurobiology, which only continues to expand and grow and be intriguing, to me, it felt very much like I've been this lost person from the time I can remember. And in just many, many sequentially different ways, God has come and found me, and not least being in the work that I've now been privileged to be able to do. And as I say to people, I don't deserve my life for 100 different reasons. And this work that I've been privileged to do is just one of a number of those reasons.
Did you grow up in a Christian home in the Christian faith?
I grew up in a home that was part of a small community in a small town in eastern Ohio, and I was I grew up in this faith community of evangelical Quakers. Okay. Now, when I say that, it was a small denomination, and so sometimes people who are familiar with evangelicalism, not so much as it now gets, as that term is used or thought about, or the imagery that it evokes, but as it would have been understood back in the 1960s and 1970s, it's still difficult somehow for some folks to kind of put together the notion that you can be a Quaker and you can be evangelical at the same time. But that indeed was my heritage. And out of that space, my experience of encountering Jesus in some respects, you're kind of immersed in this from, you know, because you're going to church from the time you're born. And there's never a time that you don't know about it. But for me, I probably had some of my first serious encounters with what my spiritual director would say he believes was the Holy Spirit moving in my early teen years. But that was the community in which I was being nurtured at the time.
Did you always see a close relationship between your faith and your medical profession, even before you decided that, even before, as you say, psychiatry found you?
Mm. You know, Shana, that's a great question. I think, you know, looking back on it, I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that as human beings, as we go through time and space, As we like to say in our business, you know, we understand our lives by looking through the rearview mirror and not by looking through the windshield. You know, in the present moment, there are lots of things that are happening that I don't pretend to understand completely, but only understand more effectively in retrospect. And, you know, the farther I go in my life, the more life you accumulate and the more I feel like I better understand. At least that's my sense, better understand even the earliest years of my life. And I would say, you know, I think I was a kid who, for whatever reason, temperamentally, and, you know, kind of growing up in the faith community that I did, that I think there probably wasn't much about life, whether it's vocation or anything else, that was not being run through my head in the light of you know, following Jesus into whatever that topic happened to be. And this is not to make me out as some particularly deeply spiritual person from the time I was a young age. It probably was as much about some of my tendency to be obsessive about things and a bit ruminative about things. In ways that were always not always helpful or useful or healthy, I would suggest. But I did find myself probably asking the questions about what does it mean for me to be a Christian in fill in the blank, in whatever these things were. And so I think I'd had a lot of practice at asking that question. And again, not because I was even that self-consciously religious about it or thought that that was the right thing to do. It just kind of like breathing for me. And so when it came to the practice of medicine, there was never, I think, a time when I wasn't asking that question. I remember when it became, at first I, psychiatry had always been, when I was in medical school, psychiatry had been one of the half dozen primary rotations that you have to go through as a medical student. And I understood it to be, you know, just one of those things. I had no interest in it. I had no inkling or thought that it would ever be something I would actually seriously consider doing. But once it became clear that I had been kind of, again, found by this profession, then I had to contend with the notion of like, my goodness, how does one actually practice psychiatrist as a believer? Like, if you're going to do this, what does that look like? And I remember that then became the next question. How do I do that? And at a conference one year, I had the privilege of meeting the person who at the time was the medical education director for Emory University's medical school. And she was a practicing pediatrician. And I remember her saying to me, you know, the reason that you might not be able to answer the question, what does it mean to be a Christian and be a psychiatrist, is because we don't really have that many models out there that can tell us how to answer that question. And she said, I think somebody needs to do that. And I think you might be some of those, you know, one of those persons who can help us figure that out. And I felt like, you know, again, it was as God was coming to find me in a conversation that that enabled me to feel comfortable and confident about wading into these waters, despite the fact that I wasn't really sure where I was going. So I think that that question, I know this is a long-winded answer to your question, but the question of at what point was I thinking about the place of spiritual formation and Jesus' presence and all those kinds of things in the practice of medicine probably was already a movement that was on the loose before I even ever got to medical school.
Well, I think so many believers today, they see the connection in their faith and their vocation as being my Christianity makes me a really good whatever I am. And that seems obviously true for you, but there's a more direct relationship to faith.
Yeah. I mean, you're being very clear in your question. I would have to say that I was when I was in undergrad and then certainly in my medical school days, I was introduced to a group called the Coalition for Christian Outreach, now called the CCO. It's a campus ministry group based out of Pittsburgh that now has an extensive network of campus ministers throughout the eastern part of the U.S. And they had been nurtured in the way of Reformed theology and nurtured in the way of really asking the serious question, what does it mean if Jesus really is the king? If he really is, if we're going to use that motif, that language, if he is the king of everything, if he's Lord over everything, what does it mean then for us to be anything vocationally? So early in my undergrad years, I was invited to consider that question, no matter what I would end up being. And I think it also, a Reformed way of thinking about vocation was part of my heritage. But I also think this, Shane, I am struck by the depth to which we as a culture, whether we're believers or not, we operate in a fairly pronounced kind of Cartesian dualistic fashion. So that the fact that we even say something like, my Christianity helps me be a better fill in the blank, as if somehow in God's economy, those are separate things. As if somehow we are I've got this spiritual part of me that's over here in this compartment. And then I've got my software engineering part of me that's over here in this compartment, or my parenting part of me that's over here in this compartment, or whatever the compartment happens to be. And I think that I've been deeply influenced by the work of Leslie Newbegin, of N.T. Wright, of others who have, I think, drawn our attention to this false dichotomy that if you were a first century Jew, you know, this notion of having these separate categories would seem a bit strange. That we serve a God, the biblical narrative would seem to suggest that, you know, we serve a God who's created a world of wholeness, so that we actually aren't people who have these separate compartments, as it turns out. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't, you know, create categories to talk about them to help us be better parents or better engineers or better Uber drivers or whatever it is that we're going to be. But somehow the sense that I have these different, you know, parts of me, apart from being helpful abstractions to help talk about these different parts themselves, isn't necessarily what really takes place in the time-space universe. And certainly, one of the things that this work of interpersonal neurobiology has done has been to kind of reintroduce the false, you know, like bring to our attention this false dichotomy of these kind of Cartesian dualism and this notion that we are these separate things. And so, you know, this wherever I go, where I'm invited to speak, you know, one of the texts that we pay a lot of attention to when we talk about this notion of integration, this bringing together of well-differentiated parts of our mind and into bringing them together into effectively linked dynamic whole processes, is the 86th Psalm in the 11th verse, where the psalmist is asking God and says, quote, create in me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. Recognizing that our heart really is made up of divided parts that potentially can be at war with each other, but not that necessarily that God is going to bring together and make us a homogeneous whole. I'm just, my heart is just going to be one thing and one thing only. But that I'm going to be brought together in the things that I sense, the things that I image, the things that I feel, the things that I think, the things that I do with my body are all going to be linked together in this integrated whole, such that being a believer and being an architect, being a believer and being a chef, being a believer and being someone who, being a janitor, like these things are coming together in whole ways. So I'm not having to separate that out, such that in whatever I'm doing it under the Lord, and I think that this the work of and interestingly enough, the neuroscience itself and the research on attachment processes, for example, I think are really helping to reintroduce us to this biblical notion of wholeness, over and against this rather Cartesian dualism that has created so much fragmentation in the way we live our lives.
One of the negative things about Christianity in the last, 100 years or so in America is that there is a real thread of anti-intellectualism. And I wonder if you felt, as a Christian growing up, if you felt encouraged or discouraged to pursue something in the sciences.
It's a great question. Again, you're full of great questions. You must practice this a lot. It's interesting. My experience was that I think I had the privilege of being around people, especially I remember the pastor who was the pastor of our church in my developmental years between, while I was in elementary, middle, and high school. I think of the, a handful of professors that I had in my small, Quaker undergraduate experience. I think of a couple of my friends, in particular, one of my best friends in the world, who's now a professor of philosophy at the King's University in Edmonton. His name is Jeff Tudiak. I was surrounded by people who just naturally asked questions and took science seriously. And there wasn't a lot of conversation in which, the question was ever, asked, well, is this okay to do? I mean, we just did it. It was kind of understood in my experience that God is the creator of things, is the creator of things that we can explore and measure. And in fact, Neubegin himself, again, points out rightly that the whole notion of Western science stands on the shoulders, largely the Cappadocian fathers, those early church fathers and mothers who were responsible for the development of the doctrine of the Trinity. So, when we actually look at the history of Western science, we see that it would be very unlikely that we would even have it if it weren't for Christian faith, if it weren't for the experience of people who believed in a God who had created a universe that was fairly orderly and therefore able to be measured. Something actually that most people at the time of the early first millennium didn't really believe. The world was seen to be very, very chaotic, very unpredictable. The gods, you never knew what their temperament was going to be like. And this was some of what, some of the soup in which I was basting as I grew up. Now, I would say, I had encounters with some family members who, for instance, especially when I was starting to venture into the field of, showing interest in the field of psychology and in psychiatry in particular, I had some folks who were a little more worried because, oddly enough, even though I had, there were folks, and this was not particularly in my academic experience, but just family members who were quite comfortable with the notion of the hard sciences and the God of the Bible. The notion of psychiatry started, could make people a little more nervous because, quite frankly, the history of psychiatry, the history of psychology was, largely associated with people who went out of their way to try to take God out of that equation. When you're talking about Freud, when you're talking about others who were fairly robust in their pronouncement of God just being a construct of somebody else's mental activity, we understand why people would be nervous about those kinds of things. And frankly, I think that played into some of my own personal reticence about this. I think it wasn't until I started to encounter real human beings, real people in the medical field, in the field of psychology, who were deeply committed to Jesus and had already begun that process of asking really good questions about what does it mean to be in this particular field of science as we follow Jesus. that you know, enabled me to feel increasingly comfortable doing that. And some of that, again, you know, my nervousness was, some of it is about, you know, interactions with family members. Some of it is about, you know, my own personal makeup, where I worry that if I don't know absolutely everything there is to know and make sure that I'm never going to be wrong, then I get anxious. And to this day, that can still play a role for me. What's interesting about your question for me as well is that I am well aware of the depth and breadth of the phenomenon that you're bringing to light. This notion that in many circles of faith, of Christian faith, there's been this nervousness, there's been this distress, this discomfort with the bringing together of faith and science, and how do we do that? I think what's been so striking for me is that I feel like I've been a bit of an outsider hearing about that phenomenon, because that has not been my personal journey. And so I think the work of the folks at BioLogos, who have done just such phenomenal work at helping people become increasingly confident, not just comfortable, but confident about this notion of what it means to come together, bringing our scientific inquiries into the world of faith and vice versa, making them, as I've said, a non kind of dichotomized world, I think has been really, really wonderful. And I think the other thing that I've found is that the interpersonal neurobiology itself, Shane, has, for many people that I've encountered, been something that has really brought a lot of freedom to people who have these deep, these deep questions and distresses around what have been, you know, said to them, are these deep inconsistencies and incongruencies. And so again, I think as Paul writes, or as Paul is quoted in the book of Acts, chapter 14, God doesn't leave himself without a witness. And I think that at this, you know, who knows? I mean, neuroscience is a pretty sexy thing these days. You know, I tell people, look, if you want to sell more yogurt, you know, slap a picture of the brain on your, you know, advertisement, and it will, you know, it will certainly make sure that you sell, you know, that you sell more of these things. Just because we feel that much more, you know, compelled by anything neuroscience. And so who knows how long this will last? You know, in 10 years, it might not be nearly as impressive to people. But I would say that for such a time as this, where people are paying more attention to the significance of neuroscience and attachment research, this is exactly where God is going to move and use the very things he has created, use the very science that emerges out of his creation to bring people into this story that he longs for people to join in.
You talk a lot in Anatomy of the Soul about concepts of faith and certainty. And I think that there's a real big connection to the things that you were just talking about, because a lot of Christians have this belief that's really a belief in certainty rather than a belief in Christ. Mm. And also a belief that if they doubt, if they let go of that certainty, that they might lose their salvation. Mm-hmm. And in turn, what that does is it seems to make Christians avoid things that might cause doubt, things like neuroscience, mm-hmm. or psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems like there's a vicious cycle there.
Right, right. Well, I think you're right. I think there is a vicious cycle there. And, you know, I am the chief among sinners. I mean, I would be the first to admit that whole notion of being made anxious around not being certain about things was a major driving force in my early developmental years. And as I mentioned earlier, to this day, there are moments when it still, you know, it can reach up and tag me. But one thing I have become persuaded of is that, you know, we use those words like certainty as if there is such a thing. And this is the beautiful thing about this, again, one of the beautiful things about neuroscience. In the second book that I wrote on shame, you know, what I think we come to discover is that nervousness about not being certain is all about shame. I don't just simply worry that I won't be certain. No, my fear about that has to do with what I imagine the consequences of that to be, that if I'm not certain, if I'm wrong, potentially, the consequence of that is that I'm going to be made to make sure that I know that I'm wrong. And that's all about being judged, being criticized, being pushed to the outside of the in-group. In some way, shape, or form, my not being informed correctly is going to leave me in a place that we would say shows up in the second chapter of Genesis, where God says, it's not good for man to be alone. And that then is put on full display in Genesis chapter 3, this notion of how shame just creates this cascade of increasing distance and aloneness, right? The woman from God, even in the beginning of the conversation with the serpent, where the serpent wants to talk with her about God as a third person, as opposed to bringing God right into the conversation. The distancing that takes place between the woman and the man, between the woman and the man and God, and between man and woman and creation and so forth and so on. That whole sense of being left, of being abandoned, of being pushed out, is one of the primary, even pre-verbal and non-logical, non-linguistic functions of shame. And my need to be certain is all about avoiding that. And the gospel is a story in which Jesus comes, and he, and this is the thing that Newbegin, I think, is so helpful, has been helpful for me with, right? That Jesus is not going to come on our terms. I mean, look, it's Christmas at the time that we're recording this. It's the Advent season. And if it had been up to me to tell this story, Jesus would have shown up much as Aragorn shows up, you know, at the last battle, for Middle Earth. I mean, he would not have come as this vulnerable, innocent newborn who allows himself to be in the responsible care of human beings who, like, who knows what they're going to do. Like, you know, he shows up and then Herod starts murdering and then we got to get to Egypt and back. Like I would not have written the story this way. I want a God who can come and triumphantly, like, rid me of all of my brokenness. I don't want a God who comes and invites me into a place of vulnerability that, as it turns out, he actually made me to be in the very beginning, like naked and unashamed. He's recreating a world in which we will be naked in the sense that we will be vulnerable, but shame will not be part of the conversation. Therefore, those who are in Christ, there is no condemnation for those who are in Jesus. And I got to tell you, Shane, like, I love that verse in Romans chapter 1, but for the life of me, I have a hard time living as if that's true. And so I realize we're kind of a far distance away from what it means to be certain about science and faith and so forth. But I would suggest that in the end, we don't avoid science because it has anything to do with science. We avoid science for the very reason that you pointed out. We avoid science because to encounter it means we're going to have to take seriously and encounter the parts of us that are vulnerable, that carry the weight of our own personal lifelong history of shame, let alone the history of our parents and our parents' parents and so forth and so on, and all the epigenetic front-end loading that we have from generations of this stuff. We're going to have to confront that. And for us, it becomes like, as we might say, you know, if I'm a 4-year-old in my bedroom at night and the hall light is on, and the hall light is casting a shadow into my room across my closet door that's slightly ajar, and I'm worried that there might be monsters in that closet, and I yell for my dad to come in. I just want my dad to come in and turn the light on and close the door. But my dad is more likely to walk in and say, hey, let's go take a look in the closet. And I'm thinking, like, this is a really bad idea. Because there might be monsters in the closet. That's why I want him to close the door. And yet he invites me, he picks me up, and he said, let's go look in the closet. And I think this is what Jesus is doing with these dark places in our heart that are terrified that we're going to find out something in science that's going to shame us into just like, well, we're wrong as Christians. There's something like something about all this, right? Jesus, his life, his death, his resurrection, that somehow we were wrong. And I think that gets back to this notion that in the end, I really do, I want a world in which I can firmly depend upon myself as an individual to figure this stuff out. But you see, what I really need as that four-year-old, when I'm afraid of the monsters in the closet, what I really need is not the certainty that there are no monsters in the closet. What I need is the presence and companionship of my dad as we go look for them. And you see, this is the gospel. The gospel is a message in which Jesus comes and says, I am with you, even to the end of the world. And notice, he says, in this world, you will have tribulation, but don't be afraid because, like, I'm here. And we talk about, both in Anatomy of the Soul and in The Soul of Shame, we talk about how, you know, even venturing into questions of science where we are most worried, the real question is, the problem there is not science. The problem is that my distress about that venture reveals the parts of me that are clearly in isolation and disconnected, both from myself, from my God, and from others. And that actually, as it turns out, is an opportunity for God to allow the presence of others to walk with me into this science and discover what God is actually doing there. But the most important thing is not for me to end up learning that, oh, I can know everything and be certain, as it turns out, but know that I can learn that even in the hardest of places where I'm most afraid of my shame being revealed and me being thrown out, God is bringing companions to walk with me to demonstrate that this is who Jesus is in order for me to practice for the heaven that is coming. Because heaven is not going to be about certainty in the way that we like to make it. Heaven is going to be about God's presence. And if we're not getting used to practicing God's presence, even in the hardest places, I mean, my goodness, what's going to happen to us when he shows up in all of his glory?
It's interesting how it seems like so many of us are motivated by the fear of shame. And even in the little things, I was thinking the other day about how when I was in undergrad and in seminary and preparing for what I thought would be work in the church, people would often tell stories to teach us, to show a point. They would tell us stories about some young rookie pastor who had, you know, some crazy idea about how ministry would work or theology or something like that. And when I entered into ministry and started pastoring, I never wanted to be that naive pastor. And so I wanted to be the seasoned, veteran, wise pastor right out of the gate.
Right.
And so what that caused me to do was to just be very quiet. You know, you can't be wrong if you're not saying anything.
Absolutely.
To not take any chances or risks or try anything new.
Right.
And that makes me so sad looking back now, because we, you know, failure is such a great teacher, and that's what it's for. And if I had known, as you were saying, that Christ would be walking with me through those, whatever they were, those mistakes and those risks, and that naivete, that's such a better lesson to learn. And living, as you were alluding to, you know, living with the motivation of avoiding shame at all cost, is, it's not really the abundant life in Christ that we were called to.
Yeah, I mean, Shane, I couldn't have said it any better than what you just have. I think that you know, the first thing you said that I think is really important is to recognize that, you know, shame shows up most powerfully and most effectively because it shows up in micro moments, moment to moment to moment throughout the course of the day. You know, when I'm training people about this, we talk about how most of shame's content in our life does not take place in for most of us in large dramatic events. Mm-hmm. It's true that there are people who have large dramatic events that are shaming, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's any kind of like traumatic event. Those things do happen. But even for those folks and for the vast majority of the population, shame actually is most prevalent in the moment to moment expressions inside the privacy of my head where I say, I should have done this, I should have done that, I shouldn't have done this, I shouldn't have done that. Or the very act of remaining silent, so as you rightly said, if I don't say anything, I can't make any mistakes. So in that sense, the very act of remaining silent is a way for, as we call it, my shame attendant to say to me, you're right, you should remain silent because, you know, no one wants, you know, you don't want people to see that you're an idiot. Even if those words don't go through my head, that really is what I am incorporating into my neurobiology by remaining silent in those moments. And that's why one of the things that's so striking to me about the number of times throughout the biblical narrative that sin and shame are coupled so frequently. And why it is that shame is spoken about and spoken to as significant kind of portions of our life that that God's renewal is intended to change and to shift. I think, you know, we go back to this notion that you know, we create many, many things in our world, whether it's furniture or symphonies or software or highways. Or relationships, for that matter. There's nothing that we create that is more powerful than those things that we create in states of great vulnerability. When we are in deep need and need the assistance of someone else's brain, it is in those places where some of the most beautiful things that are made are created. And so we get back to Genesis 2:25, that the man and the woman were naked and unashamed, this sense of like, we ask the question, what would you create? What would you do in your life if you were not able to be ashamed and you were able instead to be completely vulnerable in proper ways with the people in your life by whom you want to be most deeply known? And we find that so much of our creative energy really is kind of tied up in and siphoned off by the need that we have to manage all of our shame. And there's a lot of our emotional and intellectual spiritual capital that ends up just being dedicated to managing all that. And so I talk a fair bit about in this book and The Soul of Shame about the significance of vulnerability in community, and that's not just something that we do in order to just help us feel better. It's not just about ridding us of shame. It really is about allowing us to be in places where we can be unleashed to be creative in the way we were intended to create. How many of us have things that we would create and do that of which we are right now completely unaware? Like, we don't even know because it's been so long layered under many different subtexts of shame in our life's history. And so, you know, to your point about, you know, I'm always sure that when I go to conferences that I am the dullest pencil in the box. All these other psychiatrists are out here who just know everything and I want and everything. And it's a powerful reminder of how God is calling us out of these places of shame, not just so that we can feel better, but so that we can actually be liberated to create in the way that he envisions us to create.
One of the themes of Anatomy of the Soul, and maybe the overarching theme, is just this idea of being known and being known to ourselves and to God and to others. And I just think that for so many people, that is such a distant concept that it seems too abstract. And I wonder what you would say that actually looks like when we're known.
Yeah. Well, it, I would say, I'll give it an example. This is a patient of mine who, I've been working with, who, when I first, the very first conversation I had, this is a person who's, in their, you know, they're middle-aged adults, and came to see me because there were, some, you know, for all of their, for all of the effectiveness of their life, if you were to look at their work, if you were to look at their family life, look at a lot of different things, everything was firing on all eight pistons. Everything's working really well, but this person carries this undercurrent of anxiety that they couldn't really explain, couldn't get around. And this person themselves would look at their life and say, like, I've got nothing to be anxious about. So in the course of our time, standard psychiatric evaluation, the first time you meet a patient, you ask some questions about their developmental history. And one of the questions I asked was, well, tell me about what life was like growing up in your house. And he said to me, you know, I grew up in a really loving Christian home, and I had two really loving Christian parents. And then I asked the next question, which of course is not one that we typically ask at cocktail parties, and that is, you know, what who was in charge of discipline at your house? As I tell people, you know, we sometimes can have conversations with people about most things, but you know, asking somebody in common conversation, well, who was in charge of discipline in your house, isn't a question that we ask most people just at our parties. And he paused and thought about that, and he said, well, as it turns out, I guess my mom was in charge of it. And why was that? He said, well, I guess my dad had a bit of a temper. And then he went on to say, as it turns out, he was actually rather brutal. Now, what that means, of course, is that this person thinks he knows his story. And if anyone were to ask him, what was your life like growing up? And many of us can answer the question the same way. I grew up in a loving Christian home. And how is it that he's told his story over many decades in such a way that is the truth of his story, until someone starts to ask him a different set of questions? And you see, this is an example of something that is different between knowing things, right? My patient believes that he knows something to be true about his life. But for him to be known by someone else in the room who's looking at him and asking him a different set of questions, it started to evoke all kinds of feelings in him that he has for many decades worked intentionally but non-consciously to keep at bay. Because for him to grapple with the reality of the brutality of his father, who was also a deacon in the church, is really not a very pleasant thing to have to encounter. And so we live in a world in which, you know, knowing things is a premium. I want to know that I know, because knowing things leads to power. It leads to confidence. It leads to my not being vulnerable, my not making mistakes. And I use my left brain largely to know things. But to be known by someone else means that I'm not the one who's going to ask all the questions. To know things, like the scientist, means I'm going to decide what the questions are so that I can ask the questions, get the answers, and then I can know everything I need to know. It also means that if I'm the one who's asking all the questions, I limit what the possible answers could be. But when I'm being known by someone else who asks me, well, who is in charge of discipline in your house? a question that no one has ever asked me in my 5 decades of life, I am now set to being curious about something that I couldn't ever be curious about, wouldn't have ever been curious about, until, or less, someone asks me that question and gives me the sense of like, oh my gosh, I'm being known. I'm having to admit to someone else that my father was brutal. And if I, and in the very process of saying this to Kurt, I feel waves of grief and sadness and even shame, because this is my life that I've been working really hard not to have be exposed. But Shane, here's the beauty in all this. If I'm able to reveal to someone else the parts of my life that are shaming, and I'm looking at someone quite literally, I'm looking at them and their facial expression, their body language and so forth is something that is projecting back to me a message of compassion, a message of understanding, that categorically changes the very experience I have of the memory of what it was like to live in a house where I had a father who was brutal. And this then reveals a couple of things. It is an example of how what Paul means when he says in 1 Corinthians, when he says, there are those who believe they know in ways that they ought to know better. But the person who loves God is known by God. Again, there are those who know things, who think they know, who do not know as they ought, but the person who loves God is known by God. He repeats this in Galatians as well, Galatians chapter 3. This notion that to love God first means for us to be known by God, not that I know God. I think it's interesting. He doesn't say the person who loves God knows God. It doesn't mean that we don't know God, but Paul's emphasizing, what does it mean for us to be in this open space where we are going to be known by someone in all of our vulnerability? And in that space, have that vulnerability, and particularly those places that are broken, healed, and reconnected and reintegrated. I'm struck by the first words of Jesus in the Gospel of John. John 1:38, the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus's words are often, especially in Mark, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. In his first words in the Gospel of John, Jesus echoing God's first words to the couple in Genesis chapter 3 after their eating of the fruit, John the Baptist's disciples are following after him, and Jesus, turning and seeing them following, said to them, what is it that you want? What are you looking for? He's inviting them into a conversation in which he wants them to be known. He's asking them for input. He's asking them to reveal who they are. This is what God's asking all of us. God's asking us, who is in charge of discipline in your house? And he's not asking that just because he wants us to deliver facts to him. He wants us to answer that question because he wants to enter into this deeply connected relationship in which the parts of us that we hate the most, that are neurobiologically well-practiced and well-hidden, he wants to reveal them in order to heal them, in order to regenerate them, in order to know that he sees those longings that we have, those desires that we have, those broken spaces that we have, including those joys that we have, and wants to validate and affirm that, and then say, here's what I'd like for us together to do with those things. And so to be known is to be changed. Neurobiologically, my friend, when I ask him the question, who was in charge of discipline in your house, his brain can't encounter that question and not be changed. It's going to be changed. And that's what we mean with the work that we do and with our little nonprofit that we've started, the Center for Being Known. We're really serious about wanting to expand this mission of asking the question, what does it mean for people who are in churches, as organizations, for the organization of the church, in businesses, in educational settings? What does it mean when people are willing to be committed to being known? Of course, we're going to we're going to take care of all the logical, linear, factual information that we need to download. Of course, we're going to teach students math. Of course, we're going to develop our software. But in the course of all this mission is intended for relational flourishing. But so much of what interferes with relational flourishing is not about the absence of information. It's about the absence of relation. It's about the dearth of what it means for us to be known by one another in order for those parts of us that are ashamed to be liberated, in order for us to create educationally and in our businesses and in our churches the very communities of goodness and beauty that God envisioned in his first days of creation.
You spend a few chapters talking about sin, and I like that you frame it as a rupturing in a relationship with our relationship with God and with others, depending on the sin. And I wonder what neurology and our faith have to tell us about why it seems we sometimes have sins that we can't overcome. Why, like Paul says, the thing I don't want to do, I do. And the thing that I do want to do, I don't do. I'm wondering how we can be informed about that through neurology and again, in our faith.
Yeah. You know, one thing I pointed out, I think even in the introduction of Anatomy of the Soul, is that it's not a book, and I don't think there will ever be a book written that's going to explain the mystery that we encounter in the biblical narrative when the Bible presents its big issues to us. The issues that are the biggest in the Bible, I think, are mysterious in the end. I don't think they're going to be ones that we're ever going to explain this side of the new heaven and the new earth, because I don't think explaining them is the point. Now, we would love to explain them. Because that, again, that gives me it's one more way for me to, you know, pick from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and know that I know that I know and not have to depend upon relationship to travel this earth. But just because I think we can't fully explain those things, explain sin through the lens of neurobiology, I don't think doesn't mean that we can't, that neurobiology isn't helpful in giving us a better view and giving us some ways to effectively address it. And by address, I mean to like engage and encounter what we experience on a day-to-day basis. And I really do think that I think it's true that sin, it seems, well, when I say it's true, I mean, like I'm persuaded that sin is primarily a turning away from relationship, rather than turning toward relationship in the face of distressing emotional states. I think that's what Eve did with Adam, what Eve and Adam did with God. We turn away from relationship. And that turning away, we can't do that without there being embodied neurobiological implications. So we like to say in the business, those neurons that fire together, wire together. So the things that I practice doing, those things become more permanent. So if I practice not paying attention to particular emotional states, if I'm someone who grew up in a house where every time somebody got angry, somebody got hit, anger might be something that is so terrifying to me that I'm just not going to let myself consciously pay attention to it. So the minute I sense myself feeling that, I'm going to turn my attention away from that. I'm going to practice cutting myself off from being angry. Now, that doesn't mean that my brain is not going to register anger with me in other ways. I'm just not going to pay attention to that. And I'm probably going to pay a price for that in some way, shape, or form down the line. But if I practice any particular behavior, whether it's a thought, a sense, you know, responding to a sensation or an image or feeling, those things are going to register and become more permanently embedded in my neurobiology. And then when the time comes for regeneration, if I decide, oh my gosh, like I'm waking up to my anger and I want to do something about that, or I'm waking up to my shame, or I'm waking up to any number of different things, my awakening to it can give me the opportunity to create new neural pathways wherein which I can begin to practice living differently than I have lived in the past. But the challenge is that that doesn't mean that those old neural networks that I have been practicing for so long are suddenly just going to like wither up and die and go away. Which is why, you know, we learn so much from the people who are in, recovery work, drug and alcohol, substance abuse work, you know, when they say like the only thing that stands, be, you know, people who've been sober and in recovery and their lives have been changed and regenerated over 20 years, they haven't had a drink in 20 years. They say the only thing that stands between me and disaster is one drink. Because with one drink, I can reactivate and turn on some of those old neural networks that I've been effectively working to try to starve over the last 20 years. And so, we see where, you know, Paul writes in Romans 7 about this notion that, you know, the person that I want to be, I'm not. I think we have to be, you know, careful about how we use that scripture, because I think as a number of folks have pointed out, you know, what Paul's talking about there is the person who's not necessarily been, you know, immersed in Jesus. There's some conversation and debate about that, but I mean, I think many people would say that what Paul's talking about is the person who's really not living in Jesus. Like these are the things that we wrestle with, like the person I want to be, I'm just not. And neurobiology has some things to say to us about this. And even after we come to Jesus, you know, even Paul was able to say that, you know, there are moments when I want to despair. I don't, but I want to despair. Well, goodness, you'd think that if Paul was wholly regenerated on his road to Damascus, you'd think that despair would never have been something he encountered after that. You'd think that, you know, he would only ever feel joy. But that's not the case. You would think that if Jesus himself were what we often want him to be, that he wouldn't need on the cross to ask God to forgive those, for they don't know what they're doing. Why doesn't Jesus just say out loud, to all of you who have hung me here, I forgive you, for you don't know what you're doing? Mm. Why is it that Jesus asks for help? Why is it that Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, asks for help? Why is Jesus like so quick to receive Magdalene's offering of the ointment before his crucifixion? Why is he so willing to allow and ask for his disciples to wash each other? So like, we need help. If Jesus needs help because this is how the Trinity works, and they're more than happy to help each other, our regeneration requires practicing new neural input, recognizing that old neural input is always going to be at the ready. Evil has no intention of going quietly into the night. It knows its days are numbered, even if that means it's another 10,000 years. And as such, it will take advantage of every opportunity to reactivate every old neuroplastic tendency that we had that we hate, which is why regular, daily, moment-to-moment, weekly confession is so necessary and beautiful. Because we're regularly confessing, I don't have all the answers. I'm not certain. I'm afraid. I'm ashamed. These old things in me that I thought had gone away got reactivated today when I got on the phone with my mom and I wanted to yell at her. Right? But you know, I'm 40 years old. Like, what's a 40-year-old who's a follower of Jesus? Like, what are they doing wanting to yell at your mom? Well, you know, maybe it's because you got some things to yell at her about that you were too afraid to yell at her about from the time you were born to when you left house at age 20. And those things are pretty powerfully embedded literally in your body. And the answer to that is not to give you a quick fix solution. The answer to that, again, is confessional community that continues to invite us to turn our attention to Jesus and turn our attention away from those neural firing patterns that tend to take us down the rabbit hole so frequently. I mean, I think this is what Jesus does in John 21 when he reinstates Peter. I mean, who knows how many times Jesus asked Peter if he loved him, if those were just 3 times or 33 times or whatever. But we get the picture that when Peter was grieved in his heart that Jesus asked him yet a third time, I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, Jesus knows that Peter is still ashamed. Jesus knows that the answer to this question is really like, no, okay, I don't love you, because if I did love you, I wouldn't have thrown you under the bus 6 weeks ago. And Jesus, I hear Jesus going after Peter's residual old neural networks, bringing them up to say, like, these things are going to want to continue to fire, and I want you to stop paying attention to them, which is why you found yourself out, you know, fishing, out back to your old stuff. Like, dude, I told you a long time ago, I'm turning you into a fisher of men. You're not going to do that work anymore. I want you to stop paying attention to your shame and start paying attention to me. I have work for you to do. Jesus doesn't bring out Peter's shame again just to rub his nose in it. He brings it up to say, yep, this is really active. And in the middle of this activity, I want you to see me looking at you and telling you, I have work for you to do. I want you to lead my people. And like, can you imagine, like, if I'm Peter, I can't imagine a world in which Jesus would ask me to do that in light of what I've done. And this is exactly what Jesus is doing. But I want to say that in that process, in that real embodied encounter, Jesus doesn't just give Peter information abstractly about the notion that he's now reinstated and things are cool. No, he gives him a real experience in front of everybody else, in which it's not just Peter's abstract mind that has changed, it's everything about him that has changed in those moments. And that becomes, I believe, a model for what we are to be doing with each other in the body of Jesus, and doing for and with each other with people who are outside the body of Jesus. I mean, we are a royal priesthood to everybody else in the world. We're not better or worse than them. We're called, though, to demonstrate this notion of what it means for us to be fully known by doing it first with each other and then with those who are not part of this family, because we want them to know that Jesus wants them to be part of the family. They are part of the family. It's just, can you wake up to that reality?
Well, Kurt, I could legitimately talk with you about this stuff for another couple of hours. I just found it so fascinating and something that the church needs so badly. But I'm just so thankful for the time that you've spent here on Seminary Dropout. So thanks for coming.
Shane, it's been a privilege, and thank you again for your thoughtful questions. And it's been very humbling, and maybe some other time we could do this again, but I'm really glad for the opportunity to do it today. So thanks so much.
I would love to do that. And for those listening, I always have links to the books that we discuss on the show notes for this episode. So definitely do that and check out Anatomy of the Soul. And I'm also going to put a link to Kurt, your nonprofit, Center for Being Known. Mm-hmm. I've been on your email list for a while, and I just think it's really important for people to find those resources. So for those listening, check out the Center for Being Known, and I'll put a link to that on the show notes. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.